seems to be a hush falling on the room, as if hush of expectation, as if people expect the things to start. So I will very quickly make a couple of announcements, and then I will hand you over to Sarah Grace, who is going to introduce our speaker. After the hectic beginning to our disabilities and abilities series with 3 lectures in 6 weeks, we do have a little bit of a break. We have about a month until John Lindau will be here on the 19th of November, and he's our Utley lecturer. In other words, he's a folklore and medieval lecturer, and he's talking about maimed bodies and broken systems in the old Norse imaginary on the 16th, as I say. And Shigehisa Kuriyama is going to be here from Harvard University talking about, the lecture of his talk is Towards a History of Distraction, and that's on the very last Friday of the Friday of the semester on the 30th of November. And he's going to be talking, he's talking about a picture. It's partially an art historical talk, isn't it? Holbein, is he talking about Holbein, I think? Two things before John Lindau's appearance that are coming up fairly soon. One is, and you've heard this from me several times, you probably don't want to hear it again, is that we have Baba Brickman doing his Rap Canterbury Tales on Monday in the Gateway Theatre down on High Street, and it's at 2 o'clock, 2 o'clock to 3:30. I'm not sure how crowded it may or may not be. It might be wise to get there a little early, I think. And on Friday, October the 26th at 3 p.m. in Cochlin's Hall, room 232, you'll be getting more details about this later, we have Giuseppe Vecellotti, who is the program coordinator and instructor from the field school at Pozzeveri. He's in the Department of Anthropology, and what this is an archaeological, medieval archaeological dig, and he's also it fits very well with our series, because he's actually particularly interested, or the project is particularly interested in traces of disease and sickness and so on, archaeological traces. So it will fit really quite well with the series that's fallen into our lap. And so he will be conducting a colloquium. He'll give a presentation, and then we can have a discussion afterwards. So those are the only two things before our next lecture, but I think they both look entertaining and interesting, and I hope to see you there. So with that, I will hand you over to Sarah.
Hello, welcome. It's with great pleasure that I have this opportunity to introduce to you Julie Singer. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Romance Languages and Literatures at Washington University in St. Louis. Her doctorate comes from Duke, and she wrote on Lines of Sight, Love Lyric, Science, and Authority in Late Medieval and Early Modern French and Italian Literature and Culture. And she spent a year at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. And before that, she has a double BA in both French and Italian from the University of Maryland College Park. So, and I think that double of French and Italian is a really unique part of her profile. I was talking on the way here to a colleague who sends his regrets, but was interested. He said, what kind of text does she work on? And I said, well, she works on Villon and Froissart and some of those texts of the late medieval French period, Molinet, the grand rhetoriqueur, that typically people don't like to work with a lot when they're French medievalists. They go for Chrétien de Troyes, the great Arthurian romances. But when you bring the Italian into the picture, as well as this lens of disability studies, I think the titles that you're using are casting a very interesting light on some of those later texts. She has a special collection that's coming out now, Disability and the Social Body. Her book came out just this last year, 2011, called Blindness and Therapy in Late Medieval French and Italian Poetry with Boydell and Brewer. some interesting journal article titles talking about clocks and mechanics and allegory in Jean Froissart. Neapolitan translations, Boccaccio's Andreucci da Perugia, so going across to the Italian side. Cataract removal as metaphor in 14th century poetry. Really interesting title and crossover. Well, without further ado, I won't read all of them, but I hope I've tempted you to dip into Julie Singer's very interesting mind, and I welcome you to this lecture. Thank you. Her title today, I'm sorry about that, is Mental Illness, Self-Violence, and Civil War. Please help me welcome Julie Singer.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for welcoming me as a part of this series. It's a pleasure to be here. And if I'm not speaking loudly enough, please flag me down. In late 1405, Jean Gerson sought to scare the king and his court straight with an account of the horrors that the current political disorder had wrought. Pillage, rape of virgins, married women prostituting themselves, church arson, murder, and worst of all, qui pille, people killing themselves out of violent madness and despair stemming from the unendurable pressure of living. Auxir soi-même par rage et désespoir des contraignants qui ne peuvent endurer. People like Perrin Levaché, a butcher who hanged himself in September 1418, after both he and his wife had been seriously ill. Two of their children had died as he watched helplessly, and having lost most of his possessions because of the wars, he could no longer feed his family. On June 10, 1413, Jacques de la Rivière, once chamberlain to the Duke of Orléans and later to the Dauphin Louis of Guyenne, now a prisoner, was found dead. He had smashed his own head in, unless a member of the opposing Cabochin faction had done it. Depends whom you ask. Either way, the dead knight's cadaver was reportedly carted to Les Halles and re-decapitated for good measure. And in the late 1420s, a solitary scholar in the 10th year of his self-imposed exile from the court of the Dauphin, the future Charles VII, was reading chronicles of French history. Struck by the contrasts between his country's illustrious past and its pitiful present, he fell into a deep depression. Though he repeatedly came to the brink of suicide, he ultimately called upon his inner reserve of faith to pull him through. In the first decades of the 15th century, it might well have seemed to many French people that the world was not only growing old, a mundus senescit, as writers like Eustache Deschamps never tired of reminding their public, not only growing old, but going quite mad. The scarcely mentionable malady of the insane king, Charles VI, was soon mirrored at every level of social experience. From the irrational civil war through which the body politic tore itself apart, to Gerson's report of elevated suicide rates among the common people. In this political environment, affairs of state were closely linked to the ruler's mental state, but Charles's condition, precarious at best, seems to have been largely off limits for contemporary writers. Chroniclers avoid any language that would cast the king's mental condition in an overly negative light. Poetic allusions to the king's madness remain oblique. While Charles is known to us today as Le Roi Fou, the Mad King, in his own time he was acclaimed as Le Roi Bien-Aimé, the Beloved King. The obvious questions, whether an intermittently insane man is fit to rule, and what effect his mental illness might have on those whom he governs, are dismissed outright on those rare occasions when they are even raised, as in an anonymous 1406 pamphlet, The Songe Véritable, True Dream. But this is not to say that the political implications of mental disorders remain unexplored in early 15th century French writing. Indeed, I will aim to show you today that the tact that the delicacy of the king's condition demanded, in combination with existing metaphors of governance, gave rise to innovative ways of representing the psychological dynamics of the body politic. Discourses of mental illness and of social harmony converged not where we might expect, in discussions of the king's malady, but rather in literary characterizations of ordinary citizens' suicidal violence. In the texts I will discuss today, self-violence is an act marked by political implications that far exceed individual mental health concerns. Suicidal actions may be attributed to any number of causative factors not limited to mental illness or impairment. Of the examples with which I began this talk, for instance, only the last bears any relationship to a medical cause, melancholy. The others are conscious acts brought on by duress, and so would not have been classified by medieval jurists or authors as having come from mental illness. So this talk doesn't tie into this year's lecture series theme in exactly the way you might expect. I'm not really interested in thinking about mental illness as a disability and suicidal actions as a symptom or manifestation of that disability. Rather, I will argue that suicide is presented in early 15th century French texts as a cause of a disability of a different sort, a direct attack on a surprisingly corporeal body politic. Before we delve too far into this topic of suicide, I'd like to provide a bit of historical context. Charles VI's France was a country reeling from a series of body blows. And for those who aren't up on their Hundred Years' War intrigue, here's a brief summary of the reign of Charles VI, which lasted from 1380 to 1422. At the age of 12, he succeeded his father, Charles V, during whose reign the constable Du Guesclin had reconquered most of France from the English. Hostilities didn't resume in earnest until the 1415 campaign, kicked off by Henry V's drubbing of the French troops at Azincourt. But in the meantime, power struggles among the inner circle of the increasingly incapacitated French king ensured that the kingdom was anything but peaceful. First, his inner circle of advisors, the Marmousets, as Froissart dubbed them, were disbanded during one of Charles's psychiatric crises. Then the 1407 assassination of the king's younger brother, Duke Louis of Orléans, on the orders of his cousin, Jean Sans Peur of Burgundy, gave rise to civil war between the Burgundian and Armagnac factions. This conflict was especially hard on the common people, whose lands and property were ravaged by écorcheurs, bands of pillaging mercenaries. Paris changed hands several times, from the bloody Cabotian revolt of 1413 to the Armagnac retaking of the city a few months later, and then the massacres that kicked off the Burgundian occupation of Paris in 1418. The retaliatory assassination of Jean Sans Peur of Burgundy in 1419 didn't help matters either, and to cap it all off, 2 years before his death, Charles VI signed the Treaty of Troyes, disinheriting his eldest surviving son and naming Henry V of England as his heir. These were grim times, and in one notable case, they offered fodder for poetic inquiry into the geography of the pathologically depressed mind. In his Livre de l'Espérance, a prosimetrum probably begun in 1428 and left unfinished upon the author's death around 1430, Alain Chartier makes explicit the relationship between political turmoil and mental anguish. The book opens with a metric section in which the first-person authorial persona, the acteur, is reading chronicles of France's illustrious past. Instead of uplifting him, this reading material leads him into melancholic brooding about the sad world he lives in. This is the first item on your handout. I think I'll probably skip reading it, but you can take a look at that. Oh, how terrible it is to have been born now instead of in the past. Current events affect Chartier's writerly output, turning him from courtly themes and genres, and even causing him to grow old before his time. For example, the second item on your handout, I used to spend my youth composing joyful writings, but now I must weave other works. No joy can come from a grieving heart. Pain, fear, poverty, loss, and dread have so besieged my mind that nothing can slip past them unless they allow it. Accordingly, I must change my sentiment, and the word sentiment here is interesting as it can also refer to sensory perception. I lack the intellect or the sense to write anything but the way I feel. Pain, through overlong suffering, is making me old before my time, and it will not let me live out the natural course of my life. So, in pain, I begin this book. And so he does. In the first prose section, the acteur even more explicitly pathologizes the living conditions that have given rise to his depression. His petit entendement, little intellect, falls into a deep sleep, and he remains like a madman, demeuré comme homme éperdu, because the surrounding world is so full of déplaisant frénésie, unpleasant, violent agitation. And we can note the application of the medical diagnosis of frénésie, a frenzy, violent delirium, agitated madness, to the course of current history. Clearly, it is contagion from a world gone mad that has given rise to the narrator's unhappiness and to the vision he is about to recount. Now, the trope by which reading material causes dream visions, or depressed moods that in turn predispose the author-narrator toward such visions, is nothing new. The dreams recounted in Guillaume de Digulville's Pèlerinage de Vie Humaine, and also in Gerson's Songe contre le roman de la Rose, were both purportedly inspired by readings of the Romance of the Rose. And Christine de Pizan builds her Cité des Dames, which you may know, out of the depression and shame that she feels upon reading the misogynistic Lamentations of Matthiolus. Sometimes such depression is situational, as in Christine's case, but often it's complexional, that is, physiologically based. artistic and writerly abilities are frequently imputed to melancholics above all others. Indeed, this literary convention, by which a mood of despair provoked by one's reading gives rise to vivid narrative dreams, is completely consistent with contemporary medical understandings of the link between melancholy and the powers of prophecy, vision, or dream. According to Bartholomew the Englishman's De Proprietatibus Rerum, melancholics are afflicted with vivid, sensorially rich nightmares. In Jean Corbuchon's late 14th century French translation, ces gens songent choses terribles et ténébreuses, et choses qui sont très mauvaises à la vue, et puantes à odorer, et aigres à savourer. Those people dream of terrible dark things, horrible to see, and putrid to smell, and acrid to taste. Not that any author wants to think that his dream-turned text is foul or pungent, but the point stands that melancholics not only dream of stranger things, they also simply dream more than others due to their complexion's effect on memory processing. Or as the physician Évrard de Conti remarks in his translation of the pseudo-Aristotelian Problemata, Book 30, Question 1, and this is the same question in which it's famously stated that melancholics make the most gifted writers, philosophers, and statesmen. He writes that the melancholic humor, and I quote, fait la personne encline à prophétie et à divination, inclines one toward prophecy and divination. This inclination stems more precisely from an extraordinary ability to convert external sensory impressions into phantasms or figures. And this is the third item on your handout. For it is also said that the melancholic complexion causes the soul to retreat into itself as if fleeing external things. That is, it causes the soul to convert things from the world around it, in which it dwells and acts, into phantasms and images. Secondly, that such a soul is more ready to receive the impression of heavenly power than those who keep their eyes fixed on this world and on the aforementioned sensible external things. So to sum up, melancholics, who tend to make the best writers anyway, have a particular aptitude for the conversion of sensory experiences and worldly circumstances into dreams and visions. Several 14th and 15th century French writers imagined scenarios in which reading a particular book put them in a bad mood, and falling asleep while in such a frame of mind prompted vivid dreams. Alain Chartier's Livre de l'Espérance takes these ideas to a new height, for his book is the first and only one of which I'm aware thus far, in which an author-narrator, who specifically identifies himself as beset by melancholy, draws a direct causal link between reading and reflecting about political actuality and experiencing suicidal despair. And it's not just any political topic we're talking about here. It's contemporary France's desperate state of disorder. In this frame of mind, Chartier's Acteur begins the book proper. And what you have here are illustrations of the book's first episode from three different manuscripts. Sorry, I could only have this one from a black and white scan. As he sulks, an old woman approaches him. He describes her as an old woman, messy, as if she didn't care about her dress. She is Dame Mélancolie, Lady Melancholy, and as soon as she has arrived, she wraps the acteur in her cloak, which is what you see depicted in all three of these, and she disrupts his senses. She held my head with her hands and covered and obstructed my eyes so that I could not see or hear. In this manner, she fulfills her ultimate function, which is to trouble people's thoughts, dry out their body, corrupt their humors, weaken sensitive spirits, and lead man to languor and death. She is especially prone to do this to the finest minds and most elevated intellects, as Chartier is quick to point out, les hauts engins et élevés l'entendement des parfums et excellents hommes. She's able to do so because the mental faculties are housed in organic bodily structures, and this is the next item on your handout. For the four internal senses of man, which we call the sensitive, imaginative, estimative, and memory, are corporeal and organic, and they can be damaged with excessively frequent or rough use, just as among the five bodily senses, the eye is perturbed by looking at overly bright light, or reading too often, or fixing one's gaze on tiny things. The acteur is now separated from his entendement, or intellect, who lies asleep nearby, very helpful. Melancholy completes her impairment of the acteur in prose too when she lobotomizes him, so to speak, removing, quote, the part seated in the middle of the brain in the imaginative faculty which some call the fantasy, partie qui au milieu de la tête sied en la région de l'imaginative que aucun appelle fantaisie. Then the acteur espies her three minions, defiance, indignation, and despair. The first carries a double-locked coffer and purses full of all sorts of things. Indignation holds a bloody cat of nine tails in one hand, and the other, a tablet where she's written her enemies list. Despair is a disheveled mess with a knife. In the next three proses, each of these three addresses the acteur, deploring court life, berating him, and exhorting him to consider suicide. Indignation begins by insulting the acteur's retirement from public life and holding up a series of exempla, beginning with Seneca and ending with Boethius, not exactly heartwarming models for the successful balance of literary production and political engagement. Defiance then generalizes the acteur's experience to all Frenchmen, claiming that if men's inner thoughts were converted into voices, one would hear nothing but cries and sobs in every village and crossroads. Finally, despair tries to push him over to the edge, and this is the fifth item on your handout. She says to him, "What more do you think you'll see if you remain alive? Friends dead, goods pillaged, cities destroyed, forcible domination, ravaged country, and widespread servitude. What more will your mind learn from now on except how to complain and sigh, to turn food into famine and honor into reproach?" Then she piles on more exemplary suicides: Cato, Mithridates, Hannibal, Jugurtha, Lucretia, Dido, before bringing her discourse back to the present, item six on the handout. "And you, why do you want to grow old in such grave misfortune and live every day wishing for death? Your country's chivalry is dead and gone. Intellectual life has disintegrated, etc., etc. Everything's terrible. So break the bond of life that's keeping you in such bitter servitude, and with one little evil, free yourself at once from these infinite evils. Escape once and for all the dangers of fortune and forget everything, except for the fact that sooner or later you must die." The metric section immediately following Despair's harangue puts her bad advice back into perspective, its disembodied poetic voice describing the suicide as one who, quote, "wants to do such wrong to himself and, in error, falsify the noble law of nature," end quote. But the acteur is unable to heed reason, for the three demons have upended his sense, blinded him, and brought him to the brink of mortal madness. Bestourner le sang, c'est aveugler la raison, et mener jusque près le mât de mortelle forcennerie. He has been separated from his sleeping intellect, he's been deprived of his fantasia, so that now melancholy is in control of his mental images, and suggestions of suicide are beginning to sound like a good idea. So in prose five, nature, who would hate to see one of her creatures destroy himself, awakens entendement, intellect. And lest we think of nature as a mere personification, Chartier underlines her corporeality in very interesting fashion. She exerted herself so, moving all of her veins, nerves, and arteries, vertebrae, and muscles, that with her motion and agitation, she awoke entendement. Intellect is at first restored to a semi-vegetative state, eyes open, babbling. The acteur is still preoccupied with his hideous visitors. Meanwhile, entendement heads to a corner of the chamber that has previously gone unnoticed. This is the next item, item seven on your handout. And here we see the acteur, melancholy, still with her cloak around him, the three nasties, and here's entendement, who has just woken up. He's still in his nightshirt, and he's heading over to the corner to this little doorway. What is this door? Handout seven, for I had turned my face and fixed my fantasy on those three monsters until entendement went back toward my memory, and with great effort opened a little door whose locks were seized up with rust in order to admit more light. By that door, three ladies immediately entered, these three ladies are the theological virtues, along with a noble and well-turned-out young lady. The text is unfinished, and we have no idea who she was going to turn out to be. They had long stared at that little door, but no one had opened it to them. Even entendement, who opened the little door of my memory, didn't see them enter, for his eyes were still dazzled, like a prisoner who suddenly goes from a dark cell to the light of day. Here they are entering through the door. The lady's entry filled the place with light. The dazzling light and the specific allusion to a prisoner recall both the book's Boethian intertext and the comparison of mental faculties and eyesight in prose one. At this point, the acteur and his entendement still aren't completely with it, but the theological virtues interventions are about to get underway. They will ultimately heal the desperate narrator through the balms of virtue and prayer, la balme de consolation, the ointure d'espérance, ointment of hope. But the rusty little door to the narrator's memory also underscores a change in direction. Despite its external political impetus, this has become a discourse of mental health situated within mental space. So if there's a little door leading back toward the memory, we might be able to think about this in terms of the brain diagrams, the diagrams of the faculties in texts of the period. Here's a slightly earlier diagram where we can see the memory is indeed always depicted as being in the rear ventricle of the brain. So if the acteur and his intellect are within a room that has a door opening onto the memory, we can imagine that, in fact, this is a text that takes place in the middle ventricle of the narrator's own brain. This guy's really stuck inside his own head in this book. So the external stimuli that led to the acteur's suicidal thoughts seem to demand completely internalized remedies, divorced from all political context. The rusty little door may admit Hope and her sister virtues, but for the purposes of our inquiry into the political significance of politically driven suicide, it's also a dead end. We're only turning inward rather than back out to the political world. In her brilliant study of the archives of Parisian mental hospitals from the revolution through the commune and the political dimensions of many patients' deliria, Laure Murat asks, comment délire-t-on l'histoire? How do historical contexts feed delirium? I think the Livre de l'Espérance clearly fits in with such a line of inquiry. But if we wish to flip the question around, asking instead how mental illness shapes political history, we need to take a step back and consider a different set of texts. The Livre de l'Espérance is fascinating because of its obviously fictionalized first-person account of suicidal impulses stemming from disparate political and social disorder. But that prosimetrum, at least in its unfinished state, does not take the further step of reincorporating the rhetoric of suicide back into an active political message. But that is precisely what we see in texts written a bit earlier, around the time of some of Charles VI's worst mental health crises. Of these overtly political discourses that instrumentalize suicidal acts or impulses, the best known is Jean Gerson's 1405 French language sermon, Vivat Rex, Long Live the King. First of all, this would probably be a good time for me to summarize a bit more the origins, symptoms, and duration of the king's madness. Although his mother, Jeanne de Bourbon, was rumored to have suffered from episodes of mental illness, in his youth, Charles showed no signs of instability. He did, however, fail to shine in comparison with his father, Charles the Wise, and with his younger brother, Louis, Duke of Orléans. His first bout of madness came in 1392 when, shortly after having recovered from a high fever, he reportedly became overheated during a long August ride. Unnerved by a hermit's prediction of betrayal and alarmed by the sound of a lance slipping onto a helmet, the king went into a frenzy, pursuing his brother and killing several men-at-arms who dared not strike back at their king. From then on, he suffered from intermittent periods of madness, interspersed with times of lucidity, all the way until his death in 1422. While it would be nearly impossible to gauge the exact timing, nature, and duration of the king's episodes, they do seem to have grown more frequent as time went on, and in the first decade of the 15th century, they largely changed from frenetic to melancholic behaviors. Texts composed during the reign of Charles VI tend to treat his madness in highly euphemistic fashion. Christine de Pizan refers in a famous refrain to Notre bon roi qui est en maladie, our good king who is ill. And even the notoriously blunt Eustache Deschamps pens a ballad in which he discusses the king's medical regimen without mentioning exactly what it is that the king's being treated for. Likewise, Bernard Guenet has noted that contemporary chroniclers, especially Michel Pantoin, also known as the Monk of Saint-Denis, avoid terms that refer specifically to mental illness, furor, vesanus, fatuus, in favor of more general expressions of disease or infirmity, vexatio, invalitudo, egritudo, infirmitas. One of the most striking examples of this unwillingness to name or blame the king's illness comes in the pamphlet Songe Véritable that I mentioned at the beginning. It was composed in 1406 and it's preserved in two manuscripts. In it, the figures of poverty and suffering complain that the king has taken everything from them through excessive taxation and the ravages of war. Excusation, defense, then defends the king, and false government and fortune show up to take some of the blame instead of him. What's most remarkable in this pamphlet is that the word folle, crazy, and its variants are used to refer to just about everyone in the text except the king. In fact, once they have heard how the king has been mistreated by his inner circle, who are taking advantage of his maladie, the complainants retract the très folles opinions que rencontre le roi Avion, very mad opinions we held against the king. In staging the common people's hardships as a means of opening a discussion about governance, the Songe Véritable echoes Gerson's Vivat Rex, pronounced before the same Parisian court audience less than a year earlier. At first glance, Gerson's third-person accounts of politically driven despair, giving rise to self-violence, seem to bridge the gap between the Songe Véritable's complainants and Chartier's acteurs. Gerson's unnamed citizens fall into despair because of their physical and economic insecurity. Handout number 8. For fearful worry and the anguishing dread of being pillaged by princes or men-at-arms lead them into very grievous, impatient, and painful torment, such that in these times many have fallen into despair and have killed themselves. My God, how horrible. Indeed, the suffering and suicide of the common people recur in the sermon as a sort of refrain, or if you will, a framing device. The list of the common people's desperate acts with which I opened my talk today, and the reminder of their desperation, which I just cited, bookend a discussion of the king's responsibilities toward his people. Of course, there's no way of measuring 15th century suicide rates, and modern sociological scholarship is divided on the question of suicide trends during wartime. Gerson, however, suggests that suicide is at an all-time high. He does so in order to propose a model of interdependency between the different estates, wherein the common people suffer because they must pay for the folly of the lords. Quelque folie que les seigneurs font, le peuple l'achète. The greater their leader's folly, the greater the citizen's suffering. This vision depends on a series of bodily metaphors. First of all, we can note that Gerson's king has not two but three bodies, one corporeal, one civil, and one spiritual. All three are depicted as endangered in the sermon Vivat Rex. The state is a body with the king at its head. This is not an uncommon image, and we'll come back to it shortly. Gerson, however, really takes the body of state metaphor to a new level of detail. He even discusses blood flow in metaphorical fashion and other physiological mechanisms. One logical conclusion of this very corporeal discussion is that internecine conflict becomes the metaphoric equivalent of self-violence. And this is item 9 on your handout. Just as there is nothing more cruel, horrible, or hideous to the corporeal gaze than to see a natural or human body tear or dismember itself, by biting or otherwise, so too is there no greater cruelty to the spiritual gaze of reason than to see the parts of the mystical body divided and persecuting one another, subjects against lords, lords against subjects. Another logical conclusion of this physiological model is that the health of the head is visited upon the rest of the members, and that the very ills that are leading common people to take their own lives are a direct consequence of the head of state's mismanagement. You can be sure that corporeal and civil adversities come to us as a consequence of sins of the mystical body, he says, either in its head or its members, especially when those sins are horrible, strange, dirty, and vile against God and nature. Thence come wars, famines, pestilences, seditions, and divisions, end quote. Thus, although Gerson is careful not to make much explicit mention of the king's mental illness, his public was almost certain to draw that connection, especially since he delivered Vivat Rex shortly after one of the king's most alarming and politically consequential bouts of madness. In the summer of 1405, and the sermon is November 1405, in the summer of 1405, the king had reportedly stopped eating. He would not allow himself to be undressed or bathed, so he became riddled with vermin. He had hidden a little iron blade in his bed and had cut himself, and the cut had become infected. Finally, at his physician's urging, he was forcibly bathed and changed, but when word got out of the king's pitiful condition, public opinion turned very sharply against his guardians, especially his wife and his brother. And this is basically the beginnings of the rumors that his wife and his brother were having an affair. Rumors such as this in part laid the groundwork for Jean Petit's later justification of the murder of the Duke of Orléans, so much so that historian Bernard Guenet has speculated that the story of the king's miserable condition in the summer of 1405 might have been more Burgundian propaganda than reality. Whatever the truth of the situation, the story had clearly gained currency by November of that year when Gerson gave his sermon. For Gerson, no Burgundian sympathizer, refers to it, albeit obliquely. We've already seen that the common people suffer from political mismanagement, and that this suffering is embodied through physical self-harm. But the king's 1405 episode also gives Gerson reason to talk about threats to the king's corporeal body, Again, a risk of self-inflicted harm that reflects broader political tensions. This is item 11 on your handout. The king's good friends and loyal subjects must seek his health and corporeal life just as they would and should want others to do for them, removing any obstacles to his health, even if he doesn't like it at the time, for that is how everyone should want to be treated. And indeed, they would want others to hold them back against their will if, through ignorance or some other cause, they wanted to harm or kill themselves. Now, doing so to a prince would not mean resisting or flouting his authority and power, or putting forth one's hand against the Lord's anointed, but rather it would be a way to obey and benefit him, just as, if he had a sick member threatening his entire body, one would get rid of it by flame or knife. His closest blood relatives must all come together and agree to this, instead of going in opposite directions just to be disagreeable, which is basically what they were all doing. Here, Gerson manages to refer to the king's most recent episode without literally discussing it. But the mention of ignorance or some other cause prompting suicide attempts allows him to sidestep the tricky question of what vocabulary to use to discuss the king's condition. Nor does he specify how the king might attempt to harm himself, but his listeners are likely to have thought of his willful refusal to eat or bathe, his secreted blade, or other acts of symbolic self-violence that are enumerated in contemporary chronicles. And in the rather unusual amputation analogy, I'm also tempted to see an allusion to the king's summer 1405 episode. The gangrenous limb in need of removal, the membre nuisant par maladie à tout son corps, isn't so far off from the infected and rotting flesh around the king's secret wound. The iron blade, according to Jean Juvenal des Ursins, lui avait tout pourri la pauvre chair, had entirely rotted his poor flesh. It was the king's physician, not his guardians or other relatives, who finally insisted on intervening in summer 1405. Juvenal again, quote, there was no one who dared approach the king to treat him, but he had a physician who insisted it was necessary to treat him or else he would be in grave danger, end quote. So the model of good citizenship in this story is the physician, who recognizes that sometimes it is necessary to remove a part in order to save the whole, that sometimes it is necessary to go against the king's will for the greater good. Sacrifices must be made. Now, to discuss the amputation of a sick member in this specific context, where the head of state is ill, it might seem dangerously close to the treasonous suggestion that said head be removed for the good of the people. Gerson sidesteps this hazard, using the amputation metaphor to serve his broader point that the princes of the blood must all seek to preserve the king's bodily integrity in order to safeguard the kingdom. So Charles does not become another Nero, where really his suicide is the only good end that can come. No, we have to rewrite this story. Otherwise, as long as the king suffers from his malady, is all of France mentally ill? Is France a headless monstrosity, a corps sans tête, as Eustache Deschamps suggests in a dream vision in the form of a chanson royale bearing the refrain, rien ne me faut mais que j'ai un bon chef. I'm lacking nothing but a good head. It's a very funny little political poem. And what, more precisely, is the link between individual anecdotes of self-harm and the broader political damage that they may cause? I think I've already shown that beyond the obvious harm to the populace on an individual or familial level, suicide is highly politically resonant in France at the turn of the 15th century. The reason for this resonance lies at the intersection of the physiological and the metaphorical realms, in organic metaphors of the body politic that bring together discourses of bodily disability and political disunity. The first of these metaphors, which we've already seen illustrated in Vivat Rex and in the Eustache Deschamps poem that I briefly alluded to, essentially comes from John of Salisbury in its most widespread medieval form. In book 5 of the Polycraticus, John reproduces and comments upon a text that he presents as being a letter from Plutarch to Trajan. In it, the different estates are assimilated to the members of the body. The prince is the head, senators the heart, knights the hands, functionaries the entrails, and laborers the feet. These parts are interdependent, but the feet have a particular need for the head's protection. For them, if we look at item 12 on the handout, I've given you the Middle French translation along with a modern English translation. The prudence and guidance of the head are all the more necessary since the feet face more obstacles when they make their way across the land in service of the body. And just as reasonably, they're owed more aid and protection, cover and footwear, chaussement, and that's something that the French translator adds. John of Salisbury doesn't get into the need for shoes. More footwear than the other members since they take great pains to carry and sustain the very being and substance of the body. Take away the support of the feet from the world's strongest body, and it will not, for all of its power, be able to move unless it drags itself horribly and painfully with its hands, or unless it is carried or dragged by animals. The head's special responsibility toward the feet can help us understand the emphasis on poor people's suffering in Gerson's sermon. The image of the body of state dragging itself along the ground also illustrates how particularly disabling it is for the kingdom to lose the lowest of its subjects. For while a headless country presumably cannot survive, or else it just lies around on the grass, which is what happens in Deschamps' poem, a footless body is viable, but profoundly disabled. Is this why the pathos of the common people's plight is so much greater in Vivat Rex than the pathos of the king's risk of self-injury? Because their suicides erode the very foundation of society. I believe that the organic metaphor of the state, the identification of the different classes of citizen with the members of a single collective body, comes to matter a great deal in late medieval France for two major reasons. The first concerns textual proliferation of the metaphor. Borrowed from Polycraticus, it's adopted in a great many vernacular mirrors for princes, a genre that explodes in popularity from the late 14th century, from the 14th century onward, not the late. And what you see here is quite a rare illustration. Although the metaphor is widespread in text, it's very rarely illustrated. Here we have a mid-14th century mirror for princes, Avis au Roi, that does give us an illustration with these nice little scrolls identifying the different social categories that correspond to the parts of the body of state. This presence, even centrality, of the bodily metaphor is even more pronounced following the translation of Polycraticus into French, a translation executed by Denis Foulchat for Charles V in 1372, so 8 years before Charles VI becomes king. The metaphor even becomes to serve as the structuring principle for a number of political writings executed in the circles of Charles VI and the Princes of the Blood, especially, most notably, the Livre du Corps de Police, Book of the Body Politic, and other political treatises by Christine de Pizan. In fact, in three of her heavily political writings, she comes back to the structuring principle of the state as a body. So it stands to reason that with the rise in popularity of mirrors for princes, the metaphor of the body politic gains greater cultural currency. But I also hope to prove in my ongoing research that the bodily metaphor of government takes on added significance through its intertextual echoes of another metaphoric deployment of the body, Nebuchadnezzar's dream, as recounted in the Book of Daniel, chapter 2. Now, this part is still in its early phases, so much of what I'm about to tell you is speculative. It makes a lot of sense to me, but I haven't necessarily found a textual smoking gun. I'm on the lookout for one, however. As you may remember, the Babylonian king dreamed of a statue with a head of gold, a breast and arms of silver, a belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and feet made partly of iron and partly of clay. Daniel interpreted this statue as representing a succession of kingdoms, each weaker than the last. So you can probably see where I'm going with this. Another humanoid figure with different political identities assigned to its various members. But the two bodily metaphors remain largely separate throughout the 14th century. John of Salisbury's pseudo-Plutarchan political body appears mostly in political treatises and mirrors for princes, while Nebuchadnezzar's statue recurs in devotional texts, most notably the Speculum Humanae Salvationis, and also in courtly and allegorical poetry, Digulville, Machaut, Mézières. It's in the early 15th century, notably in the writings of Christine de Pizan, Alain Chartier, and to a slightly lesser degree, Gerson, that political and poetic discourses are more systematically brought together. And with them, I suspect the kingdom's two metaphorical bodies. Indeed, while John of Salisbury's model of the body of state is the one with the most evident impact in late medieval treatises on government, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar can also offer us complementary insight into the greater import of the common man's act of suicide. For 14th century courtly poets, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar offers a biblical complement to the Ovidian-inspired discourses of image and simulacrum that pervade the literature of this period. Guillaume de Machaut, for instance, pairs Nebuchadnezzar with Pygmalion in an extended diatribe against idolatry in Confort d'Ami, and pairs him with the goddess Fortune in the Remède de Fortune. In this second text, the example of Nebuchadnezzar's statue illustrates the poet's complaint about the world's instability. The metallic members represent the different degrees of fortune, from the golden heights of good luck to the degrading dirt where those who rely on fortune will inevitably end up. Machaut even warns that the upper parts of the statue aren't really made of precious metal. This is just an illusion, décevement, that has fooled those dolts, musards, who wish to believe in fortune's empty promises. We're really not so far away from John of Salisbury's body of state now if we consider the more typical iconography of fortune, for who usually sits atop representations of fortune's wheel but a prince? And I love this image because, as in many others of fortune, you can even see through the social standing of the characters on the wheel that's reflected very clearly in their style of dress. So as we successively fall away from power, down the side of fortune's wheel, or down the Babylonian king's statue, we follow a political hierarchy, ending at the ground with the destitute and the disempowered, those crushed under the goddess's wheel or under the great image's foot. Compared with the organic metaphor derived from Polycraticus, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar presents a more fragmented political vision, the bodily members succeeding rather than complementing one another, the social estates replaced with metallic quasi-prosthetic limbs, or, in the case of the common people, evanescent, fragile, earthen prosthetics. Again, as in John of Salisbury's metaphor, the feet constitute the foundation of all, but also the most fragile element. This makes them something of a canary in a coal mine before the letter, but theirs is also a fragility that extends beyond the physical vulnerability of illness, food insecurity, financial instability. The amalgamation of our two bodily metaphors for government could lead to the conclusion that the feet, more than the head, are particularly susceptible to trouble, particularly susceptible to mental illness. Not the high-minded melancholy of the pseudo-Aristotelian problemata, but a deep visceral despair and diminished reason. The weakest elements in society are not pure and untarnishing gold or even sturdy bronze. They're iron and clay. Potter's clay, as it is quite emphatically specified in Guillaume Filastre's later 15th century history compilation, Toison d'Or. Le résidu des pieds était de terre de potier dont on fait les pots et les cruches. The rest of the feet was made of potter's clay from which pots and pitchers are made. Incidentally, iron, especially rusty iron, and clay are both materials that keep turning up in medieval accounts of madness. Not to mention the significance of the mere fact that this is Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In the Bible, just two chapters after his dream of the statue, Nebuchadnezzar has another dream foretelling his own madness and ultimately does lose his mind, dwelling for years among the beasts. You can see him here doubled over among the beasts in the wild. He's the medieval archetype of the mad king, and it's therefore fitting that one of his dreams can come to illustrate the devastating, disabling social impact of mad acts of self-destruction. To conclude, the metaphor of the body politic is not new in late medieval France, but I believe that it gains new social import around the turn of the 15th century through the convergence of a series of factors. As writers like Christine de Pizan begin to merge courtly and political discursive traditions, the body politic starts to rub elbows with Nebuchadnezzar's statue. With France descending into chaos under the direction of a mentally ill king, more was at stake in the relationship between head and members than ever before. If the rest of the body didn't support the head, the result would not just be indigestion or languor, as in the Aesopian fable of the belly and the members, it would be certain destruction. Civil war itself was a form of self-violence, the members of a once integrated body tearing at one another. In this environment, suicides among the common people are deplorable, not because they are a sign of mental illness. Indeed, these kinds of stress-induced suicides are typically not attributed to mental illness at all. Nor are commoners' suicides lamented as personal tragedies. Ordinary people's suicides become a recurrent shorthand for political unrest in late medieval French texts because they constitute a physical blow at the body politic. Paradoxically, the most inwardly directed form of violence becomes a generalized aggression with the capacity to disable an entire social order, causing it to crawl on its belly, dragging itself with its hands. What are the broader implications of our reading of suicide for a discussion of disability, and please imagine that word within quotation marks, in the Middle Ages? A real act of real violence against a real body, a type of act that today we would most often interpret as stemming at least in part from a psychological pathology, is presented as disabling only insofar as it enacts symbolic violence on a metaphoric body. This has a serious potential to trouble the distinction, which has been fundamental to the field of disability studies, between impairment and disability. That is, between a bodily condition, impairment, and the social obstacles that can result from or be projected from that condition, disability. The conventional wisdom in disability studies is that one can have an impairment without it being transformed into disability if physical differences can exist without creating social obstacles. However, the inverse isn't really true. It's not possible to have a disability without having an impairment from which it stems. Our disabled body politic is just one of several medieval examples that I've found of a disability that does arise in the absence of impairment. In this case, because the social obstacle, instability, unrest, arises in the absence of a physiological body. The real bodies of the suicides are erased. What remains, what is disabled, is the body politic, which is not a body at all. This discord with contemporary models of disability offers us another way of understanding the frequent claims that disability is not a notion we can apply comfortably to medieval bodies. Personally, I see these discrepancies both as an argument against disability studies' dependence on rigid models, which are often derived from sort of social science. I also see it as an argument for the power of disability as a productive tool for thinking differently about medieval metaphor. Removing the human physical body altogether from the equation, and acknowledging that some medieval writers did the same, can help us see how the language of mental and physical illness, infirmities, and other assorted differences can enable re-envisionings of political history and of national identity. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. That's late medieval France as headless and footless. Pretty powerful images. What we'd normally do is open this up to questions now for the burning questions, and then take a break and have refreshments and put some tables together for a little bit more discussion. So I'll open up. Are there questions?
Burning questions.
That's right there. Fever or post-febrile.
I have a question. Actually, how much during this period would Aristotle's conception of suicide as a crime against the state still be influencing thinkers, or has that kind of fallen away at this point?
It's not, because It's the same sort of push of translations during which the Polycraticus was translated into French, the Ethics, Politics, and Economics were translated into French by Aurème in the 1370s. So they are present. But again, I find that the mirrors of princes, especially the vernacular mirrors of princes, tend to pay a lot of lip service to Aristotle. But if you take a careful look, they're not really deriving very many of their ideas from him. So he's frequently cited as an authority, but you see other traditions. I mean, Giles of Rome and John of Salisbury are really the ones that you see recycled in these texts. Also, I think that the Aristotelian notion, correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the impression that this would perhaps be more pertinent to a discussion of eminent citizens than of the little unimportant guys who normally wouldn't be mentioned at all in these types of texts and who really only come up sort of as fodder for the suicide rhetoric in these cases.
Well, my sense is that it's the discussion of justice, he's discussing in the context of justice, so sort of like, can you steal your own life? And Aristotle's coming away saying, no, the only way it could possibly be seen as a question of justice is depriving the state of an able-bodied citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that gets commented on a lot by Aquinas and others in Christian contexts. So,
mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Now, it is interesting to note too that the word suicide. I believe Andrew Murray, who recently wrote a couple of volumes on suicide in the Middle Ages, found one instance of suicidia in a medieval text. But for the most part, this is not a terminology that exists. And in French, the term that's most often used is homicide de soi-même, so murder of oneself. So I think that definitely places it within a very specific sort of judicial category. Also, one of the major historical sources that we have for information about common people's suicides are letters of remission. And those are particularly interesting in the context of asking whether these are illnesses that come out of mental actions that come out of mental illness, because that's usually the claim that the family makes. Right? So if they want to clear their dead relative's name, and by extension their own name, they have to prove not that their relative felt despair at his poverty and saw no other way out. They have to try to prove that he was mentally ill, and therefore it was not a rational choice that he made to kill himself. Thank you.
Oh, I have a question. You brought up the kind of Wittgenstein structure that's going on here, which is something. And I'm thinking in particular on the point you made in item 6 on the handout here.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned at one point melancholy speaking here, and the last sentence here, you know, escape once and for all the dangers of fortune and get everything except for the fact that sooner or later you must die.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost seems that melancholy is acting in a way almost replacing the lady philosopher figure, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Stretching possibly there, mm-hmm. in that it's she's acting against fortune, having to escape Fortuna.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you comment about perhaps melancholy's function as the allegorical figure. Is she kind of like an anti-lady philosophy here, or is she?
I think she's sort of like a masquerading, an impersonation of lady philosophy. I mean, you have this sort of drowsy character who is visited by a female allegorical personage as he halfway sleeps, and we have the emphasis on her garment, right, when she appears. She looks disheveled. She looks like she doesn't care about her garments. So I do think we have sort of an inverted lady philosophy there, which is then corrected when the three theological virtues arrive, and then it becomes clear that they are the real lady philosophy and that this other one was some kind of an imposter. Yeah,
she's
I believe that.
Dressed.
Much.
Good.
Yeah.
Really the opposite of...
Yes. her cloak is tattered and it's dirty. Yeah, no nice embroideries. But the fact that she takes her fingers and she covers his eyes and she plugs up his ears with her fingers, and this is the first step in how she drives him out of his mind. So again, I think we definitely see quite clearly this relationship between the external senses and the internal mental faculties, and it's through the disruption of that link, which again isolates him within his own mind, that she can begin to affect this process of derangement on him.
I don't know if you know the English poet Thomas Hopley, who is absolutely contemporary with Chartier. And he has a very, very graphic description of his own madness and his recovery from madness.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing, and I've never made this connection before, sort of listening to it at all, because this is in a prologue to a translation of
a mirror.
Of Vice for Princes.
Yeah.
Mirror of Princes.
Yes.
And your talk has suddenly made clear to me why the two go together so well.
Mm-hmm. I've not worked a lot in the past with Mirrors for Princes, but I'm becoming increasingly interested in them, not only because of this material, but also we were discussing before that my current project is on rust as a metaphor for sort of cognitive disruption. And Mirrors for Princes are one of the genres in which this appears more than once, or pedagogical treatises. Yeah.
Just going off of that, I think it's also interesting that with Hockley and the situation is that he, in I think it's the series, also has a description of his mental illness,
mm-hmm.
and his situation, and in his series is where he has the translation of Christine de Pisan's Letter of Cupid.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have like when it comes to Hockley,
mm-hmm.
this double side with like description of it with Mirrors for Princes, Insanity with Mirrors for Princes, and then Insanity with the feminist debate,
mm-hmm.
and with what Christine de Pisan is doing also.
I've read some about Hockley, but I haven't read the Hockley, and I think I should, because actually I think it's a helpful bridge into talking about this material. In a lot of the histories of mental illness, you'll find sort of generalized histories of mental illness. Hockley is typically the only medieval, or is certainly the only late medieval example that's cited. I mean, otherwise often they'll skip from antiquity to Erasmus, possibly with a brief detour into Hockleaf, really as much as there is work out there on the rhetoric of mental illness in the Middle Ages, it's Hockleaf who's gotten the lion's share of the attention. Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah. I wonder if it's maybe a time with Gower, and I'm reading Confessio of Montes right now. In book three, there's a discussion of melancholy, but specifically, he's telling melancholy to wrath. And I wonder if this listening, it seems to be a tie of melancholy to self-violence, is some of the texts you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if there's possibly a tie there of kind of a connection between melancholy and self-violence and wrath and some of the constructions of Gower's setting up as well.
I think that that's very likely. One of the, for instance, with Alain Chartier, the Livre de l'Espérance, interestingly, this is a book that's typically accompanied with one of two other writings of Chartier. And this is the case both in manuscript and in early print editions. It either appears most often with the Curial, which is an anti-curial tract, and often in many cases, I think there are two early printed editions and one manuscript in which the Livre de l'Espérance bears the rubric Le Curial, but it's even confused with this other book. But the other one is the Quadrilogue Invectif, which is, you know, Lady France deploring her sad state of affairs. And that's a text where, rather than melancholy, it is anger, it's ire, colère, who is frequently cited. And you'll see France tearing at her own garments, for instance, in some of the illuminations that accompany this text. So I would be interested in moving in that direction, too, because I think that melancholy kind of occupies a similar role in the Espérance as anger does in this, in many ways, a companion work, which is the Quadrilogue.
I wondered if you would, in the High Middle Ages, in the 12th and 13th century literature, there's this longing for death that's really evinced in troubadour, trouvère poetry, in romance. But there's not a lot of real, so, you know, there's Dido once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of discussion of suicide seems to me a real departure from those high medieval tropes of suicide. Could you speak to that a little bit? Do you see that as a real shift, or do you see some continuity of that trope of longing for death because of lovesickness?
Well, I do think we get some echoes of that tradition, especially in the Chartier, where the examples, I mean, Dido and Lucretia are both cited to him as examples. So we do have these sort of highfalutin examples of, you know, here are people to emulate who have done this, and Seneca. You have these examples. You have this tradition where it's sort of a noble impulse in a way, although to act upon it is not. But then with these other political texts, I think the fact that it is so pointedly common people that we're talking about kind of necessarily divorces it from that kind of exemplarity. But I feel like that's also, in a way, that's why it feels less like real bodies that they're being talked about, in a way, because I know that sounds kind of perverse. You know, if you're talking about mythical characters, wouldn't this be less concrete than talking about real people who have actually killed themselves? But oddly enough, in these texts, it feels like quite the opposite. The fact
that
these
kills himself,
yeah, the fact that it's a butcher that's killed himself means I can just use this as an example. I can just use this as a handy illustration of something. We're not talking about a butcher anymore. We're talking about, you know, the greater problems of the state that have been illustrated with this one example who's not exemplary in any way. I guess it uses them as examples, and it simultaneously strips them of their exemplarity, which I think is really quite a feat. So.
Really interesting.
Well, isn't that similar to political movement we see today? I'm thinking of the last election with Joe the Plumber.
Right.
Right. Just an example of kind of pulling that as you're trying to use it as an epitome of the idea you're trying to get to, the problems they're trying to solve in the country. And yet, it's really, in the end, stripping the idea of Joe the Plumber of their very identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first presidential debate this cycle, people were talking about how much more human Mitt Romney was. Why? Because he was able to say, I met a guy at a rally 3 weeks ago who told me about, you know, this is a problem I've never had. You know, I've never lacked for money, but I met a guy 3 weeks ago who told me that he hasn't had a job in 6 months, and it really touched me. So I think, yeah, it is kind of the same sort of rhetorical move. Yeah. Use somebody else's story to show that you're in touch with the reality on the ground while very distinctly maintaining your social difference from that reality on the ground. Yeah. Yeah,
Robert. Do you want to do one last and then one?
Speaking about sort of shifts, have you Have you noticed in looking at the Mirror for Princes, at least in the vernacular, or to the extent that, as like they go later on, do you see more of a shift for discussion about melancholy versus, for example, ire or rage or that sort of the insanity of anger, though, that is provoked? Mm-hmm. Because at least in a lot of Mirror for Princes I've read in Spain in the 13th century, there's constant recognition of like the king, avoid making sure that as a good king you avoid rage, you avoid this anger-based insanity.
Hmm.
And so I'm wondering if you noticed a shift to that is maybe taking place over the 14th century to a melancholy understanding or a look at the concept of insanity.
I don't think I'm yet familiar enough with the body of texts really to speak to that question. The ones I'm most familiar with are Christine de Pizan's specifically. So the Book of the Body Politic, also the Book of Peace, and the biography she wrote of Charles V. And what's interesting about these three is all of them are directed to the Dauphin Louis of Guyenne, who was one of the sons of Charles VI, who actually predeceased his father. And it was after his death that his father disinherited kind of the next son, the second. He had a whole lot of sons who died before him, but he ended up disinheriting Charles VII. But what's peculiar then about Christine de Pizan's political treatises, she uses this body of state metaphor, but she very specifically avoids talking about Charles VI at all, even though she is writing for Charles's son and she's giving him a series of positive and negative models. She almost exclusively jumps to his grandfather, Charles V, and doesn't talk about the father at all. And so the reason she doesn't end up talking much about melancholy at all, because this is a frivolous teenage guy, and she's almost exclusively telling him to stop drinking and partying so much and to be more like his grandfather. So kind of the psychological, the melancholy, the anger don't really come up in those, and I'm not yet as familiar with some of the other ones.
All right, let's stop at this point and pause for refreshment and thank
you.